Welcome, everyone, back to another edition of New Books in Education. This is your host, Ryan Allen. And today I'm excited to bring you a book that I saw a book talk on recently. And I said, you know what, I need to have these guys on my podcast. And lucky enough, they were able to facilitate that. So today I have Dr. Edmund Hammond of University of Nebraska at Lincoln. And he co-edited this book with Stanton Wortham and Enrique Murillo. And this is Revisiting Education in the New Latino Diaspora. This is Education Policy and Practice Critical Cultural Studies, and it's Information Age Publishing 2015. Dr. Hammond, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure.
If you could, maybe just tell us how this project came together. You three are the editors, but you have it's quite a large volume with other contributors. So can you kind of tell me how it came together and how you worked on it?
Actually, there's two answers to that in the sense that this is a follow-up, entirely new, but it's a follow-up to a 2002 volume called Education in the New Latino Diaspora. And that also was the three of us as editors, Enrique Murillo, Stanton Wortham, myself. And in a sense, there's a creation story about how that came together, and then there's a lapse, and then there's a creation story about the new volume. So and I'm going to briefly walk through the old volume first because it explains how the new volume is, in a sense, a response to that.
Sure.
The old volume, which is 2002, Education in the New Latino Diaspora, Enrique had done his doctoral work in Chapel Hill at the University of North Carolina. Stanton Wortham at that time had yet to come to the University of Pennsylvania. He was at a liberal arts college up in Maine. And I guess I had graduated by 2002 by the time the book had come out. I graduated in 1989, but I had done field work in Georgia and earlier while I was getting my master's degree in Kansas. And all four of us, based on different projects, had looked at Latino populations in new parts of the country, meaning in parts of the country that historically had had little or no Latino presence. Mm-hmm. And so there wasn't a history of discrimination or racism in a sense that needed to be remedied and overcome, but nor was there a history of welcome and embrace and agentive inclusion. And so our first volume collected case studies from all over the country. We each included our own work in that, but there were also, I think, eight or nine other pieces, one from rural Western Illinois, one from Indiana, one from a resort community in Colorado, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. At any rate, back, you know, circa 2000, you know, and most of the field research was completed pre 9/11, pre sort of America's sort of new militarization of the U.S. border. Mm-hmm. Before what I would characterize as a sort of neo-xenophobia. It wasn't that there wasn't racism and resistance to newcomers arriving circa 2000, but I would say it's of a different type and degree currently. At any rate, so our storyline, if you will, I mean, they're all empirical, mostly ethnographic studies, but our storyline was the interaction is often improvisational, it's often well-meaning, it's often amateurish. There are tensions related to whether newcomers are seen sort of completely as parents, as human beings, or if it's more narrowly as English learner, if you're talking about school, or worker, if you're talking about communities. But there was a intentional and sort of intentionally naive optimism to the first volume in the sense that we weren't necessarily in a position to talk about, you know, broad successful responses, but nor were we in a position to lament broad problematic responses.
Sure.
And so came out, almost all of the sites were rural, and you know, we all continued on in our careers and did additional things, and the, you know, book got decent press and was reasonably broadly circulated. And then in 2009, CLASE, and I've got to think what that stands for, CLASE, at the University of Georgia, decided to host what it called the first triennial conference on Latinos and Latinas in the United States, something akin to that, but looking basically at education in the Tuna Diaspora. And, you know, it was ironic that it was called the first triennial conference because, as best I know, there's never been a second or third. And, you know, by their math, it would have been 2012 and 2015. Right. But at any rate, at that first one, it was actually the first time that Enrique Stanton and I were all together physically in the same place for a sustained period of time. I buy the idea we'd cross paths at AERA or something like that. Mm-hmm. But this was longer. And there was an idea of, well, what if we put together a new volume and new case studies? And I had been working with a woman actually at the University of Georgia named Linda Harclaw. She and I had put together a chapter for the Handbook on Latinos in Education, and that was a massive production, about 60 chapters, that Enrique Murillo had headed. And in that piece that Linda and I did, so the Hammond and Harclaw, 2010, we talked about limitations of the first volume, and not negatively, meaning the first volume got a whole bunch of things out and on the table, but there were things that, now that the field, in a sense, was up and running, that needed or merited additional attention. So, for example, geographically, our first volume hadn't looked at all at the Pacific Northwest. Oh, maybe we should have something in the Pacific Northwest. It had been almost all rural field sites, and the new volume includes some urban and suburban areas. The first volume was almost all K-12 centric. The new volume looks at, there's one chapter on early childhood education by Jennifer Adair. There's three chapters that look in different ways at higher education, one by Catherine Richardson Bruna, one by Adam Sawyer, and then one by Socorro Herrera and Melissa Holmes, talking about the Visitos program at Kansas State University. So at one level, the new volume was, let's fill in some holes. Another, actually, I think, really interesting chapter in the new volume, it talks about the experience of Latin American origin, Latin American identifiable adoptees as a population growing up, often in mixed race families, and, you know, often to white parents. And sort of the question of how well positioned are white parents to understand and promote sort of identity development of kids who quite distinctly physiologically different.
Right.
And, you know, there's, again, it's sort of raising up the issue that that too is part of the new Latino diaspora experience. At any rate, so the new volume sort of got cooked up in 2009 at this CLASE conference, this triennial convening. And then it was just a matter of sort of looking out and about for prospective chapter authors. We used the chapter that I did with Linda Harclaw for the Handbook on Latinos in Education. We actually used as the first chapter for the new book. That's the only one that's really a reprint. And even then, it's not completely a reprint because we kind of use it as an explanation here. According to our 2010 analysis, is where the field needs to turn next. And then we added, literally italicized sort of paragraphs, we added how this 2015 volume attended to some of that.
Sure. So,
but anyway, I would argue one more important point is that the new volume is more skeptical or even critical. You know, these places often have had 15, 20, 25 years to mount institutional, thoughtful responses. And, you know, it's not that there are no stories of success anywhere, but by and large, if you look at high school graduation rates, if you look at continuation rates on the four-year colleges, if you look at achievement test scores, if you look at sort of community ideologies about inclusion and exclusion, there's still a long way to go. And it's not, you know, I'm willing to give somebody a temporary pass of, improvisation, meaning, well, trying to figure it out. But if 20 years on, you're still trying to figure it out, there's an additional storyline. And there's something, in a sense, less flattering about what one needs to describe.
Sure, sure. If we could maybe jump into some of the parts of the book, and you actually have it broken up into three sections. The intro, of course, which you kind of talked about. But then the section two, actors, improvisational local practice, which you sort of have off to the side, grassroots to policy.
Right.
And can you kind of maybe talk about sort of how that section What sort of some of the themes, or maybe even if you want to get into any of the specifics that that can really capture what that
means. Sure. And so this book fits into a series that more than anything has an anthropological take on policy implementation. Mm-hmm. And so traditionally, in a number of fields, we tend to think of policy in a kind of top-down nature. You know, policymakers, understood as political leaders someplace, cook up an idea. And then the question is, how do the different people who are charged with various responsibilities in relation to that policy, how do they perform those tasks? And actually, the third part of the book somewhat follows if this is the policy, what happens on the ground? Here, I mean, policy ideas don't come from nowhere. They come from often anecdotes, often direct personal experience. And so when we say grassroots to policy, the idea was to frame particular circumstances and really point as a question, well, what about policy? What about larger frameworks that would be responsive? So Erica Bruning, who actually was a doctoral student at the University of Nebraska when she was doing this research, and now is at Nebraska Wesleyan University, she studied a high school where there were 4 identified English language learners. So 4 out of 600 kids. And, you know, she calls it a low incidence population. And, you know, I think they're very interesting and real questions. What is the capacity as well as the responsibility of a school to respond to 4 kids, you know, less than 1% of their total population?
Right.
And there's not an awful lot of familiarity and there's not a lot of understanding of what ought to happen. But it follows that if you're looking at a phenomena like a diaspora where you've got growing populations in more and more areas, this low incidence reality is happening more and more commonly in a lot of different places. And if you added up, you know, if you could find 200 places in Nebraska with, you know, at least one identified English learner, but say less than 5, and I'm sure we have 100 schools like that, if not 1,000 in the state of Nebraska, and then multiply that in many other places across the country, you suddenly realize that numerically, because at one level, we're making the argument that education policy needs to figure out mechanisms where in widely dispersed low incidence populations, there's nonetheless some thoughtfulness, some responsiveness to how these kids are situated and what they need. Fortunately, we're finally in an era in American history where if this was a particular special education population, for example, you know, you start to see a response. And I would argue that, well, ELs and special ed are importantly different in a whole bunch of ways, and I'm not trying to lose that point. But if we can respond to low-incidence populations in one scenario, presumably we need to figure out a way to respond to different low-incidence populations in another.
Sure.
So anyway, that's, you know, a grassroots to policy. Let's look at a particular case, a particular instance, talk about how, well, this case may be particular in terms of details. It's hardly a unique scenario, and there needs to be some sort of larger scale thought about what to do about it. If you look at chapter 3, the Luis Urieta, Lan Colano, and Jiyun Ojo chapter, learning from the testimonial of a, and this is in quotes, successful undocumented Latino student in North Carolina, actually, it introduces the term testimonio, which shows up again in several of the other chapters, and I think it's an important idea, and I'll circle back to that.
Sure.
But in brief, chapter 3, and I won't do this with every chapter, mind you, but this is a useful second example.
Right.
Basically, Luis and his colleagues were interviewing this college graduate as part of a different research project, and then, it was in a recorded interview. And he, I think, trusted the interview process enough, the interviewee, that he felt safe basically articulating at length and in detail a complaint. You know, he was frustrated that constantly he was, you know, being asked when people talked a little bit about his background and circumstances. He was undocumented, but he'd been able to secure, through the assistance of some others, scholarships to get through 4-year university experience, earn a degree. Mm-hmm. And people were like, oh, aren't you grateful? Isn't that terrific? How many people sort of helped you? And his, at least superficially surprising response, not necessarily surprising if you think about it, was, no, I'm angry. And, you know, that set up the question, well, why are you angry? Didn't lots of people sort of generously figure out a way to have you move around all of these obstacles? And his point was, why were there all of these obstacles that needed moved around? And, you know, he was somebody who'd come as a kid to the States, bought into an American storyline about, you know, study hard and you'll advance, you know, this generation ahead of the generation that precedes it and so forth. And, but, you know, concurrent to some version of welcome, some version of school saying, we'll help you develop academically, it was also constantly telling them, but you're different. We're going to need to make special accommodation. Here's an obstacle we'll throw at you that we don't throw at anybody else. And so it was ultimately, even though it was successful from a did you get a degree standpoint, it was quite fraught and problematic. And I think he articulates quite movingly, and you know, this is one case, but again, back to policy at a larger scale, he articulates quite movingly the Dreamer case, Dreamer meaning the Dream Act pending legislation that has been, you know, up for consideration for 14 years in a row now by Congress and it's yet to pass. But this idea of students who come here as children and then have the developed capacity to contribute substantively to American public life, and yet we restrict them and don't come up with means to do that. So from a grassroots to policy standpoint, here again is, you know, a particular case, a particular instantiation, and yet it's in service to a larger argument. I would make the point that the remaining chapters in this section, each telling sort of different pieces, continue on in that vein. One of the sort of undergirding theoretical frameworks of the book we propose as a definition of policy, and policy to talk about putting our kids to bed in the evening, or policy to refer to something as substantial as No Child Left Behind, I would argue that all policies share three ingredients: a problem diagnosis, strategies for the problem's response, and then a imagined better world where if the policy is enacted, here's what the new reality is supposed to come look like. And so these first, these chapters in this section, chapters 2 through 8, really, in a sense, lay out problems. Here is something that this case says this is problematic and you might not have thought of it as a problem. Mm-hmm. They're less prescriptive in the sense of laying out strategies for what ought to happen other than, well, and that varies actually. Some of the chapters do say more than we need to think about this. They propose particular solutions. And all of them imagine a world where newcomers, where the student and family populations that we're talking about feel more welcome, are allowed to be more agentive, and, you know, a diverse, inclusive, more peaceable society is, in a sense, the imagined new reality. So in that sense, grassroots to policy very much is let's identify problems, possible strategies to remediate the problems, and a better world. And they point in that direction. But the in a sense, they're an argument for policy rather than examination of extant policy, or they're arguments for new policy that doesn't exist, even if they critique to some extent, some existing practices.
Sure. And so then the next section, section 3, which is the next half of the book, basically it talks about existing, or it's titled Existing Infrastructure Responds. So can you kind of talk about how that is sort of organized, and maybe is it a sort of response to those things that you're maybe suggesting in the first part? Or that would just naturally have occurred, even if they're not sort of things that maybe you would recommend?
They're not direct responses, but I would say they are indirect responses. And if anybody looks at the table of contents and recognizes that when I was talking about, you know, section 2 of the book, and I said chapters 2 to 8, and they're like, but wait, it ends with chapter 9. chapter 9 and chapter 17, 9 at the end of section 2, 17 at the end of section 3, both proposed to be sort of composite cross-case analyses of the sections that they're part of. Mm-hmm. So in the case of Section 3, which you've just brought up, we basically look at things like teacher preparation, And actually, we look at that in a number of different ways. So chapters 10 and 11, 10 is by Francis Quinteros, Tom Stridicus, Catherine Torres, and Karen O'Reilly Diaz, looks at teacher attitudes across the state of Washington. So there's an example from the Pacific Northwest. But looking at whether new, and I should say newish, there's the history of migrant agriculture in Washington that's quite multi-generational. But at any rate, in terms of an established and growing population, it's a new phenomenon. And they look at teachers, largely white teachers, making sense of these newcomers and scrutinize, are the academic expectations the same? Are they different? Things like that. But the policy, in a sense, that is being examined is the state-endorsed protocols for what readies a teacher. And then they juxtapose, well, you know, this is what teacher preparation is supposed to entail, and then these are what teachers are telling us about extant realities in schools. Mm-hmm. And then you can ask questions about the teacher preparation. Does it do what it should? Does it do what it can't? And that's, I think, an important question, but we're calling it a policy question, sort of coming down, you know, from, because the, in this case, teacher preparation policy is long standing, is well established, and we're juxtaposing empirical information vis-a-vis described policy.
Sure.
In a similar vein, Jen Adair's chapter, chapter 11, Early Childhood Education and Barriers Between Immigrant Parents and Teachers Within the Latino Diaspora, she looks at two cases, one from Iowa, one from Tennessee, of preschool teacher readiness and preschool environments where newcomer Latino children form large parts of the enrollment. And invariably, the teachers talk about how they want more parent involvement, they want more parent engagement, and the parents suggest that they have at least some skepticism as to whether their feedback, in fact, is fully and completely and without qualification welcome. And with some degree of accuracy, she shares cases where, you know, the parents finally do feel that they can be candid about what their kids experience and what they're hoping for. And not surprisingly, but sadly, it leads a little bit to a defensive response on the part of some of the preschool teachers. Mm-hmm. And this is, we're calling this an examine of, you know, policy responds. Again, this is, you know, the posture of the teachers is, you know, here's a problem. We need more parent engagement. And yet when they get more parent engagement, they don't actually necessarily want it because it includes messages that challenge worldviews, that suggest changes in strategy that they're not willing to necessarily pursue. So, you know, I mean, it's perhaps a little bit just trying to come up with the organizational logic of a book in terms of big part two, big part three.
Yep.
But we would propose here that the starting point is, you know, what's extant policy where these preschools, you know, how do they imagine a client population, in this case parents, and what do they do about it? And that's the sort of existing infrastructure, the school responding to the changing demographic, a changing blend and mix of parents, mm-hmm. And what are they doing about it? So when we say infrastructure responds, you know, it turns out that in the new Latino diaspora that, and we're particularly interested in education institutions, but we look at how the different prospective stakeholders are involved and how the institutional infrastructure that pre-exists these stakeholders responds.
Okay. Well, I know you have to get running here pretty soon, but maybe just one or two more questions. If you could, I know there were sort of innovative methods kind of used in this, and one that I found particularly interesting is sort of some people were videotaped themselves talking, things like that. You also were able to come up with sort of a documentary out of, I think, some of these studies. And maybe just once you answer that, if you could, just last word on the book, what you hope people take away from it.
Okay. In some sense, the book is the dry academic, this is, you know, careful, formal, empirical analysis and study. And I absolutely want to stand behind it for that. But it's also the case that if you ask a broader question about education in the Nuvvuatuna diaspora, taking field notes and analyzing them is not the only strategy available. Mm-hmm. And if a goal is to communicate things that we're learning, and have the things that we're learning be consequential for changed policies, then we can ask questions, is a book the only mechanism available to us to do that, or are there other ways of sort of capturing some of what's going on and sharing it with audiences? So in the presentation at Teachers College that you saw, that mm-hmm. you alluded to, Stan Wortham, my co-editor, shared some video of work that they have done in a mid-Atlantic suburb of a big city. And they chronicle sort of new ethnic fair kind of celebrations down on Main Street. They chronicle how this is a community that before and after World War II welcomed large numbers of Italian Americans, how this elderly Italian American population and then their second generation children make sense of, oh, well, this is just the newest wave of newcomers, and we were newcomers, and sort of the processing that goes on. And I think that video footage, in some, there's the old storyline that picture, shares a thousand words. I think that these initial forays into additional mechanisms to share information are promising,
sure.
in part because it engages people in a broader sensory sense. You hear stuff, you see stuff, as well as just reading and imagining from text. So that's part of what you're talking about. And then we also showed a clip from which isn't otherwise part of the book, although we do have two chapters in the book that are from Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a documentary that a former student and a friend of hers put together. The documentary is called When We Stop Counting. It was ultimately produced by Nebraska Educational Television, and they do a nice job of basically a year in the life of six Latino and Latina students in Crete, Nebraska. Crete is a meatpacking community. It's recently become a majority Latino school district enrollment, and these reasonably successful students in different circumstances, one becomes the first Latino president of his high school's National Honor Society, for example. They reflect on what it's like to grow up in a smallish town. The town population is about 8,000. Some of the surrounding farmland feeds into the school district, so it may have a service area of about 10,000 people. The high school is 800 kids, and these are six of them. And they sort of walk through their experience. And, one of the things that we would claim is, in complement to this book, there are other pieces that are also capturing dynamics of what we're calling the new Latino diaspora. And mind you, let me go back actually as a final word on this idea of new Latino diaspora. We realize in the 2010 Haman and Harkala piece in the Handbook on Latinos in Education points out that in claiming that this is a new phenomena, we risk, at least depends location by location, but we risk erasing a history. So, for example, Maria Herrera Sobek, who's a folklorist, has chronicled corridos, which are simplistically characterized as Mexican folk songs, talking about Mexican workers and steel towns in Indiana and Michigan and Pennsylvania and so forth, at the beginning of the 20th century. And, we're looking back at these communities and saying, oh, this is a new phenomenon. And if it's entirely new, then, well, what about those histories of people 100 years earlier? What about this neighborhood in Detroit called Mexico Town? How did it get that name? So in using the word new, part of what we're trying to highlight is that at scale, there's phenomena going on. There's improvisation and new sort of problem identification, problem solving being attempted in more places and at a scale different than previously happened. We're not going from 0 to 10, but we are, depending on the place, perhaps going from 2 to 8. And so there is something new, although that doesn't mean nothing ever like this has happened in these places before, varying place by place. So that caveat matters, but we would hold on to the idea that, in provoking readers to think about, well, is this new? Part of what we're doing, I think, is describing scenarios that they otherwise might not have thought of. And I guess as scholars, our ultimate faith is in the idea that if you put ideas and experiences and information in front of people, you position them better to understand the world and then make decisions about what would be fairer, what would be more inclusive, what would be more responsive, and even give them some ideas as to what they can do, they, the reader, to help make that so.
Sure.
Our target audience, for example, is undergraduates, you know, in college, pre-service teachers. I use this book. I teach a class called School and Society. I use it with, you know, 200 students a year through that venue. We also would use it in graduate classes where you get superintendents, you get principals, you get, you know, sort of people coming back to university for an additional degree. You know, we want, you know, for a handful of readers, this will be like, at last, my story is being told. And for a bigger number of readers, oh, I hadn't thought of that. This is interesting. You know, and both of those responses, I think, matter.
Okay. Well, that sounds good. I know you have to go. One final question, quick elevator pitch. What are you working on next?
That's plural and complicated, but the quick version is I've also been part of a project for about 15 years looking at kids in Mexican schools that have prior experience in the U.S. We tend to think of Mexico and Latin America's sending area. Oh, they send us families. We don't normally think through how some of that migration is circular, and there are folks here who end up there. And, you know, if you can imagine a kid with a last name like Ramirez went through kindergarten through grade 7 in Oklahoma, and then they're suddenly in a school in Zacatecas, how ready is that school and how ready is that child to suddenly switch and go to school in Spanish for the first time? That child may have grown up in a household where Spanish was used at home, but it really wasn't a big presence in Oklahoma schools. So we're starting to ask questions about how Mexican schooling, particularly Mexican public schooling, is challenged, and Mexican teachers are challenged by a growing population of kids with experience in both countries.
Okay.
So that's next.
Fantastic. Well, we'll look into that. I know you have to go. So I want to thank you, Dr. Hammond, for joining me today, and I want everyone to check out Revisiting Education in the New Latino Diaspora. And to all my listeners, I hope you learned.